Hello, in this audio snippet, we're planning to continue with the post-American Civil War period and go specifically into the election of 1876. But for some reason, as I was thinking about doing that, I felt like strong inner voice saying, "No, don't do that just yet." And then I realized that we had to talk about something else, and it's related to things that have happened recently, and it's basically related to a 3-day period, you could say, between the 6th of June and the 8th of June. So we'd like to go through those 3 days and talk about things that happened there. And I believe there's a message, especially with what happened on the 8th of June, which was very significant. For some reason, it's not been really mentioned that much, especially in conservative websites, where you would have expected that to have been mentioned constantly and very loudly, but it was completely ignored, which is shocking to me. But it makes sense when you delve into the meaning of that event on the 8th of June. But we'll start with the 6th of June. This 6th of June that we had a few days ago. From the time of this recording, was, if I'm not mistaken, if my arithmetic is correct, it was the 79th anniversary of D-Day. Every time that D-Day comes along, it's always very significant to me. And it saddens me that most people don't seem to pay attention to it or make much hoopla about it. It's one of the most important dates in world history because it meant a change in the direction of the war, and eventually led to victory. I mean, less than 1 year after D-Day, the war was over. It's a kind of a figure of people taking a decisive action after much delay. That's basically what D-Day represents. Okay, finally doing what we were supposed to have been doing a long time ago. And on that particular occasion, we actually went ahead and did it finally, America. But things are different now, and I hope that somehow in this attempt to share what happened in those 3 days, somehow it will be clear how things are different now. And 79 has always been a number that bothers me. Not that there's anything wrong with a number per se, but every time I see 79, I always feel like the 8 is missing because, you know, there's a 7 and a 9, so you expect 7, 8, 9. But the 8 is not there. And 8 is a number of regeneration. And 9 is a number of power. But so it's like trying to reach power without going through regeneration. That's kind of how I see that number 79 unfolding. It's someone trying to get to a number, to position of power. Without regenerate going through the necessary regeneration process. And 9 is also a bad number in the sense that it's a good number, but I mean that in certain contexts it's a negative number if you stay stuck at 9 or your aim is 9 because our aim should be 10, and 10 is a number of transition where you, in a sense, cross the Jordan, you could say, into the promised land, where your 9 becomes a 0. So it's like you sacrifice all your power but in sacrificing all your power, you gain a one next to you, and you become, you enter into a new dimension. Now you're a two-digit number, if you see what I'm trying to say. So the transition from 9 to 10 means somebody says, okay, I'm willing to surrender all the power that I have in order to transfer myself or to be transferred to a new dimension of thinking, of understanding, or being, or whatever. And that's what America was supposed to do. That's what conservatives were supposed to do. They were supposed to give up that sword that they always hang on to, and sell it. And if they had sold it, they would have received a robe of empowerment, of a power of a higher level. And they would have then entered into a new understanding. But they kept holding on to that sword. And the sword is that sword of their understanding, their belief that in certain ideas that are fundamentally flawed, federalism, the holiness of the U.S. Constitution, and the sainthood of all the founding fathers, the Second Amendment. Even though, as we said a million times, there's nothing inherently wrong with the Second Amendment. Actually, I am for the Second Amendment. It's just that the problem with it is that it's been put in a place of relevance that it does not really have. And it's a symptom of something being put in a high position. But see, when you prioritize or give a relevance to something that doesn't deserve that relevance, you're by nature, by logical implication, it's an inevitable consequence. What you do by doing that is you kind of remove what deserved that position from it, from that place, and you push it down. So something that should be in second place, shall we say, something that should be, quote, the Second Amendment, has been replaced with something minor. So something that's much more important, much more relevant, has been relegated and completely ignored. And that's the problem with overemphasizing things that should not be emphasized, if you see what I'm saying. Even if it's right, even if something is correct, if you overemphasize it, and don't you give it a relevance, a priority, an importance that it doesn't really have, then you start displacing something that deserved all that attention and all that importance. And so this is what conservatives keep doing. They keep focusing on all these things and thinking, with this sword, I will fight and will win. And the Second Amendment is kind of like a very powerful manifestation or evidence of that. They say, we still have our liberties because we have our guns. And as we've said a million times, the state of Colorado has one of the, it's the probably, I don't know if things have changed, but up until a few years ago, for sure, it was very easy to get very high powered weapons in Colorado. It was just a matter of filling out the necessary paperwork and you were done. I mean, you could get, I mean, you can build up a small army in Colorado with the types of weapons you can acquire and possess legally. So the Second Amendment is alive and well, or at least last I knew, was alive and well in Colorado. Yet Colorado went from being a solid red state, as they call them, Republican conservative state, to now being to purple, and now I think it's gone blue. It has very liberal hellholes, hotspots throughout the state, and now that the liberals have more or less taken over. What good did the guns do? What good did so if you don't change the hearts of people, the having a gun in your hand is useless. But we need it in case the government comes against us. Well, the government comes against you nowadays. I think they have a few more weapons than than we do. And I mean, that made sense. That militia concept made sense 200, 300 years ago, but nowadays it doesn't make as much sense. You know, we have the guns, but still, the country is being taken over. We have the Second Amendment. It's not been revoked, and the country is dying. And I find it ridiculous when people online make comments about, you know, criticizing Europe, you know, the UK or other countries in Europe, saying, oh, you know, they don't have these liberties because they let the citizens, let the government take the guns away from them. And I go, what? So, well, we still have the Second Amendment here, and look at what they've done. So, but that it's that idea that determination to hold on to the sword, this natural means of fighting, with this natural sword to defeat the enemy, and it used to work in the past, and they just keep thinking they're going to do it again and again, and it's not working anymore. We mentioned this before in the previous audio snippets about, for example, Carrie Lake, who got the election in Arizona stolen from her. She should be the sitting governor right now. And a lot of shenanigans and that went on in that election, clearly, the election was being overseen by her opponent, which is a clear conflict of interest. But she lost, you know, lost, and she's been, you know, with all that spunk and fervor, like, oh yeah, the problem is that we let ourselves get pushed around, but we're going to fight back. And she's been suing in the court system, and after a lot of evidence that was shown that clearly displayed very troubling issues with the election. The judge just threw the case out, and it's over. So, and she may be appealing, but it's just this constant obsession with fighting with the sword of natural means. And you have Daniel Penny, the fellow who had the incident with the Michael Jackson impersonator. You know, the guy died, and. Because he was trying to use his natural understanding, natural means to fight the battle. And he just clung to that methodology, and that led to the guy being, dying. And I'm not against him having restrained the fellow, but the fact that he kept the chokehold on him and didn't do something else. He didn't think out of the box, didn't try anything different that would have maybe changed the situation. Maybe there would have there would have been no need for the confrontation to begin with. I saw this article recently where he was talking and saying it was talking about how he doesn't even use the subway anymore, because of the thing. I think he's free on, must be free on bail or bond or something. I'm not sure. But apparently he's not in jail anymore. The case is still hanging over him, like a dark cloud. And, he's not used the subway anymore. I personally haven't used the New York subway in a long time. Ever since the whole virus nonsense, not because of the virus, but because they started, going crazy, with that, and out of anger, I say I'm not going to use that system anymore. At least, and I don't think I ever will again, or at least for many years. The way it looks, the thing is that he was saying, "Well, I was afraid. There were women and children in the car, and he was threatening to kill someone, and someone." And if I'd not done something, someone would have gotten killed. And maybe, there's a truth to that. The witnesses were saying, yeah, they were all scared, the people who were in the car, but in that same, train car. But I don't know. Because if the guy had been brandishing a knife, then I would have understood, okay, yeah, now it's do or die time, literally. But the guy was just threatening. He was just saying, "I'm going to bleeping kill someone and take a bullet." So he was like going on a kamikaze. There was like he was possessed, and there was, you know, he was like a possessed man, and he was just. It's like the demon was saying, "Hey, I want to die today." That's why he kept saying, "I want to take a bullet, and I'm going to bleeping kill someone." And in a sense, he did kill someone. He basically killed Daniel Penny. Daniel Penny's alive, but you know, I don't see much future for him. He may win. I don't know, but I wouldn't put my money on it. But the thing is that he did kind of kill someone in a sense. And even if Daniel Penny survives this, you know, it's basically kind of thrown his life off course completely. And I don't think he's going to win the trial anyway. But especially if he's tried in New York with all these liberal turds that roam the city. The thing is that he could have done something else. And in that moment, he could have tried to go in a different mode, but he went into marine combat mode and used his techniques. He took the sword, the natural sword he had, and he tried to deal with the situation. And now we have the consequences because he was fighting more than just the guy, the crazy guy. He was fighting the demons inside that guy, and he was fighting the whole system. He didn't realize it. He didn't understand what was going on. And he fought with natural means and he lost. And so 79 is a fitting number for the anniversary, this past anniversary being the last D-Day that America will have with its calling alive, you know, because America's going to die in a little over three months or so. America's going to be dead. So this is the last D-Day that America will live. Now, any D-Day that comes afterwards will be with a dead America, so they really won't count too much anymore. So that was the last D-Day that we'll have in our history, D-Day number 79, and it's very fitting because it's symbolic of the conservatives who were being told go up against the enemy and cross that barrier that you refuse to cross and deal the enemy the final death blow to overcome him completely. You know, just like on D-Day, the Allies crossed the British, to the English Channel and went into continental Europe, into the heart of German occupied territory, and started kicking butt. They kept holding off on that, and we'll talk about why they were holding off on that. And we've talked about this before, so a lot of this will be repeat stuff, or if you've been listening to these audio snippets, and I'm sorry if I'm going to be repeating myself in some places. But the thing is that that's what D-Day represents, finally crossing the channel to go into the heart of the matter and dealing with it finally. And conservatives have not wanted to do that crossing because to do that crossing requires a sacrifice. It requires going from 9 to 10. It means relinquishing that power that comes from the sword that they have right now and relying on something higher and looking for a higher answer. And that higher answer involves then recognizing that the sword we have does not do the trick. And that means having to say that the people who built the sword, who made the sword, the forgers of that sword didn't do too good of a job. The sword was not designed correctly to fight the enemy. But they don't want to do that. You know, they don't want to admit that their gods that they worshiped, in other words, the founding fathers, were wrong, you know, because it would be like saying that Jesus Christ made a mistake. To them, it's basically the same thing. They want to hold on to that, and that's why the country's dying. But so this January, this June 6th, passed kind of silently. And by the way, it was very interesting. I remember on one of the conservative websites, the Gateway Pundit, one of the three that I go to all the time, had this headline on that day, June 6th, and it says something about the day that will live in infamy. And it was by Jim Hoff, the man that I have cursed on occasions on these recordings. So I clicked on it, but I said, is there an angle to this? I mean, I gave whoever, I didn't know who had written it. I just saw the headline, you know, there was a picture of something related to Normandy, you know, the invasion. So it was clearly about June 6th. And then it said below, a day that will live in infamy. And that didn't make sense because a day that will live in infamy is, you know, the famous phrase that Polio Boy used when referring to the Pearl Harbor attack on December 7th, 1941. And that's the day that, quote, will live in infamy, according to Polio Boy, who's burning in hell as we speak. The thing is that I said, no, this is he saying that June 6th, D-Day, is the day that will live in infamy? And I began to think, is he going where I think he's going? But I said, no, he can't possibly do that, but you never know. And I thought maybe he's going to point out point out the delay in June 6th, you know, the fact that we took so long to finally invade Nazi-controlled territory in continental Europe. And I thought that was the infamy that he was referring to. But then, you know, I read the story and you know, it's about D-Day and about the, you know, the people who fought valiantly and so forth. Nothing significant. And then he said some other stupid thing, like a couple of other mistakes that he made in the article. And then I went to the comments section and they started eviscerating the guy. And I said, wow, it's fitting because we have... I remember one outburst. I felt like this thing, this rage that came from within me about, you know, towards Jim Hoft, and I started calling him son of a bitch like 10, 12 times, if not more. And I said, well, where's this coming from? But it was like this reaction that I was having towards him. There's something wrong with him, and not just him, the people who think like him. And it's not just him, it's a whole bunch of people. And so the thing is that they started eviscerating the guy and you don't have editors anymore who you don't proofread your stories because of, you know, the other mistakes that I don't remember right now. And then somebody pointed out day that will live in infamy. That's December 7th. You know, the same thing I thought. And why the hell is he using that phrase for D-Day? But I think it was fitting. It's like he didn't understand it, but he was using, it's like he, without realizing the demons, because these people have demons that possess them. It's just not demons that make them go out, you know, go into your subway train cars and threaten people to death. It's a different type of quote, demon. The thing is that the demon inside of him kind of felt led to put that out there. And it had a kind of a, maybe a tinge, kind of like a little bit of truth to it, but it was intended to be like a pejorative, as if to say D-Days are bad, or D-Days are days that live in infamy, D-Days are no good, that's why we avoid D-Days. And that's what he was saying without realizing it when he wrote, he mistakenly attributed that quote to D-Day, Because December 7th was supposedly the day that will live in infamy, because we suffered an unholy attack from the Japanese on that day. An unholy and unsolicited attack, unprovoked attack on America. And that's why it lives in infamy. And D-Day is an attack by the Allies on Nazi territory in Europe, Nazi France. So are we, was he, did he under, he was in a sense equating the Allies with the Japanese. You know, the Japanese attacked a righteous place that was in peace, and he was basically saying, without realizing it, the Allies were this evil force that was invading this France that was living in relative peace, because, you know, they were controlled by the Nazis and there was no immediate threat of any Ally attack on them. So it was kind of the conservative demon inside of him saying, hey, you know, I hate D-Days, because D-Days mean relinquishing the sword that I have. So it's kind of fitting. But having said all that, we wanted to briefly, or try to briefly, go through some of the things that happened on June 6th. So there is an infamy associated to it, fittingly. So it's kind of ironic. There is a level of truth to the statement. And that's one thing that demons have, people who are moved by these mindsets and all these things start saying things that are true, even though they're false. But the truth in them has sticking power and makes the falsehood stick. It's like you have like a falsehood pie with a little bit of truth inside of it. And that little bit of truth is what gives the appeal to the whole false pie, if you see what I'm trying to say. And that's the same thing with the Constitution. The Constitution, the current American Constitution, has a lot of wonderful principles. It was an amazing historic experiment of a country deciding not to live by a monarchy anymore, to be a republic. And we have, but the thing is, this is not just, and that's what founding father worshipers exaggerate. This is not like the first time in human history there's been a republic. Look at the ancient Greece, and they had direct democracy at a much deeper level than we have ever had. So it's not like a new concept, but it was revolutionary in that, in a sense, because it had not been done for so long, especially by Europeans. The monarchical rule was the rule of the day, literally. A group of people decided we're going to try to live by a different contract, like a social contract between the people and their government. And that was, that was bold and everything, but it was nothing new. You know, we had the Bill of Rights and all that, and King John in England, and all these things that happened before, centuries before, where people were beginning to make this sort of contract, between the government and those ruled by the government. And so it's not that they were new ideas, but the decision to implement such an idea was bold and revolutionary. So there were a lot of good things, but in the midst of the good things putting in these ideas that the government is somehow accountable to the people, these concepts were bold and maybe not new, but they were bold in terms of the desire to implement them at that time. And so there were a lot of good things, but they, along with all these good ideas and the concept of some checks and balances between different branches of government and all that, that's all nice and good. You know, it's not the first time it's been done, but it was good that they introduced it. So there were a lot of good things, but with it came a lot of bad stuff. So you always have this thing where if there's something, they're selling you a falsehood pie. Usually, the falsehood pie has a very nice has these icings, frostings of truth on top. And you look at the frostings of truth, and you go, oh, the pie is awesome. And then you start, eating the pie, but and it turns out to be a turd pie. And but you just because you're so sold on the truth that was on top, you start saying, well, oh, this has kind of a very exotic flavor, and you start justifying the flavor, and you eat the whole pie, and it becomes an acquired taste. So the thing is that there was a truth to what he was saying, this Jim Hoff, when he called this a day that live in infamy, not because we were finally doing what we were supposed to do, but because of how long it took. And that's what we want to kind of go over. I think we have talked about this before to some extent, so I apologize if there's going to be even more repetitiveness in what we're going to say. But the thing is, obviously on December 7th, the actual day that lived in infamy, supposedly, and I hate to keep quoting Polio Boy, but the thing is that on that day, December 7th, 1941, the US finally got involved in the war. So the war had been going on since September of 1939 when Hitler invaded Poland. And so we had been holding off for 2 years and, yeah, kind of sending some weapons and stuff to the British and all and so forth. But other than that, we were trying to, it's not our problem. It's them fighting themselves, it's their thing. And FDR, Polio Boy, kept, I don't care. I really don't care. It's not my problem. We as a nation, as always, kept holding off and holding off. So eventually the attack came. It's as if the truth came and nudged us and said, you think this is not your problem? I'm going to show you that the problem is going to come to you. It's not coming right now, but I'm going to give you a taste of what you as a nation are going to experience if you let this go on. And then we had D-Day. I'm sorry, that Jim Hoft is getting to me. Now, then we had the Pearl Harbor attack. And that's when America was forced to get involved. But when we got involved, we said, oh, we're just going to go kill some Japs. That's basically the mindset. Because FDR, as many people, or some people know, was a son of a bitch racist. And we all know the story of how when the war with Japan began, how Japanese American citizens, not Japanese illegals who had crossed the border, the Pacific Ocean to, illegally to come live here. I mean, actual Japanese Americans, maybe second or third generation or whatever. Americans were interned, like just they were their human rights were violated. They were put in these basically these concentration camps to keep them away because they were Japanese. And as far as I know, they never did that to the Germans. Well, it would have been too many people because there are a lot of Germans in America. But as far as I know, there was never a German concentration camp or German kind of internment camp for first generation Germans or German naturalized citizens or anything like that, as far as I know. But it was focused on the Japanese. Why? Because the Japanese were not white Europeans. And FDR was a racist. We all know the story, or a lot of people, at least the ones who want to face reality, know the story of Jesse Owens. We know what he accomplished in 1936 in the Olympics in Berlin. And when he came home to America, and Polio Boy invited Olympic heroes from that Olympics to the White House, he invited a whole bunch of people. And guess who he did not invite? He didn't invite Jesse Owens. Why? Because the son of a bitch was a Democrat, and as a Democrat, he was a racist. Because that's what Democrats do. Democrats are racist, and they're racist to this day. It's just that the racism is different, but it's still racism. They they are obsessed with race. And now, you know, the Democrats are the ones who have black people living in despair and poverty. Every city that's run by Democrats, black people are living in crime, bad education, poverty, and unemployment, and despair, and drug abuse, and all these things, every place. So then, you know, they just use race as a weapon to accomplish their ideology. So they end up using black people as their little slaves to do their bidding. And they just stir them up. They know what buttons to push in black people, and boom, boom, boom. And then black people turn into these automated slaves who go out and do the things that they want them to do, and don't care about them. And then they start doing reverse racism and all these things. So Democrats are about racism. It's all, they've always been racist. They are racist, and they will continue to be racist. So FDR was a son of a bitch Democrat, hence a racist. And he was a nasty man, nasty son of a bitch. So he focused on Japan first, because Japan was, you know, not a white European nation. And how dare these yellow people come attack us? So even though Germany declared war on us, we still kind of held off and didn't want to go there. And poor Churchill and all the British people were just holding on for dear life, you know, with all the raids and bombings and all this stuff, and holding on for dear life against this powerful German force that was controlling the continent. And Churchill wanted to attack Germany from the underbelly, the soft underbelly, which is Italy. He believed that the Allies, we should all, you know, make an effort to attack from the south up into Germany through Italy. And Polio Boy kept saying no. And but, you know, finally, when he decided to pay attention to Nazi Germany, he finally relented, because Churchill kept insisting and insisting, and he basically agreed. America began to get involved on the European front. But it was ironically the involvement in the European front began with the involvement in the invasion of Africa. So the thing is that we want to talk very quickly about the North African campaign. And that North African campaign officially is considered to have gone between the 10th of June 1940 to the 13th of May 1943. And in that campaign, there were, you know, fights in Libya and in Egypt, and in Morocco and Algeria and Tunisia. The thing is that, the 10th of June, 1940 is because that's the date, if I'm not mistaken, when Italy declared war. So Italy declared war on the 10th of June 1940. So then the British Army went from across the border from Egypt into Libya and started fighting. There was an Italian Fort Capuzzo in Libya, and because I think Libya had, must have been occupied by Italy or something. They had a fort there, and the British began to fight. So there was the fighting started in Africa around June of 1940, and then the fighting went on for a while. And I'm looking here at the article on. That the thing is, I'm going to read this this Wikipedia article paragraph. It says, Italian dictator Benito Mussolini ordered the 10th Army to invade Egypt by the 8th of August. 2 days later, and I believe this is 1940, 2 days later, no invasion having been launched, Mussolini ordered Marshal Graziani that the moment German forces launched Operation Sea Lion, he was to attack. And then on the 8th of September, the Italians, hampered by a lack of transport, enfeebled by the low level of training amongst officers, and weakened by the state of its supporting equipment, were ordered to invade Egypt the following day. The battle plan was to advance along the coastal road while limiting armored forces operated on the desert flank. To counter the Italian advance, Wavell ordered his screening forces. Wavell was the leader of the British forces. He was Archibald Wavell. I think that's how you pronounce it. Ordered his screening forces to harass the advancing Italians, falling back towards Mersa Matruh, where the main British infantry force was based. Positioned on the desert flank was the 7th Armored Division, which would strike at the flank of the Italian force. So by the 16th of September, the Italian force had advanced to Maktila, around 130 kilometers west of Mersa Matruh, where they halted due to supply problems. Despite Mussolini urging them to carry on, Graziani ordered his men to dig in around Sidi Barani, and fortified camps were established in forward locations. Additional troops were also positioned behind the main force. In response to the dispersed Italian camps, the British planned a limited 5-day attack, Operation Compass, to strike at these fortified camps one by one. The British Commonwealth force, totaling 36,000 men, attacked the forward elements of the 10-division strong Italian army on the 9th of December. Following their initial success, the forces of Operation Compass pursued the retreating Italian forces. In January, the small port of Bardia was taken, soon followed by the seizure of the fortified port of Tobruk. So the Italians began to suffer defeat, and it says here this this happened starting on around the 8th of September, when the Italians were ordered to invade. So like they didn't have the enough power to really do any damage, but Mussolini was bent on attacking. And on the 8th of September, he just couldn't hold on anymore, any longer. And he felt, he ordered his troops who were weakened to invade, he ordered them to invade Egypt, and things just didn't go too well, for the Italians, and the allies began to have, victories and so forth. And you may say, why am I reading that? But I do believe, and I don't understand the full extent of this, but I know this is all, I know for sure this is all very significant. And just before we get into D-Day, or the things related to D-Day, let me mention a little bit about Mussolini, the guy who ordered his Italian forces to attack on the 8th of September. Even though they didn't have the strength to win, and it kind of makes me think of the 7-9 thing. You know, it's like the conservatives don't have the weapons to defeat the liberals, but they keep saying, let's launch the attack, you know, let's go forward and attack. So Mussolini, he's a very peculiar fellow, very, very peculiar fellow. Let me just look here at his article on Wikipedia. He was born with a very peculiar name. If I can get to it, his name is Benito Amilcare Andrea Mussolini. And his name was Benito because his father was an admirer of this Mexican Benito Juarez. I'm not sure how the Italians knew about Benito Juarez, and I barely know what he did. I've just heard his name, but apparently his father liked Benito Juarez, so he named him after that. So he's named after a Mexican, which is kind of weird. And Amilcare, or I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Amilcare is a name that means it's of Phoenician origin, and it means brother of Melkart. Melkart was a god, and interestingly, one of the more, it says here, one of the reading behind the name.com, it says this was a common Punic name. Among the notable bearers was Hamilcar Barca, a 3rd century BC Carthaginian general who was the father of Hannibal and Hasdrubal. So Hamilcar is the name of the father of Hannibal, the famous guy who, you know, almost defeated the Romans. So he was given the name of the father of someone who came close to defeating the Romans. So it's kind of an Italian guy giving his kid a name that is related to someone who almost defeated their people. Kind of weird. And by the way, that, you know, Amilcare, which means brother of Melkar, the name Melkart, that god, Phoenician god, literally means king of the city. And this was the name of a Phoenician god worshipped especially in the city of Tyre. And we all know the story of how Tyre went down. Tyre was this city, a very strong, fortified city, and it was like no one can defeat it. And one day there was this fellow, this Greek dude called Alexander, and he said, I'm going to conquer that place. And you know, one of the things that Tyre had was, it had, you know, because it was surrounded by water, it was strongly fortified. It was very difficult to get to it because, you know, you had to cross the water and get to the place. And by the time you got to the place, you know, they were shooting at you from the walls. And so it was very difficult to make it. But, you know, just like, just like Normandy on D-Day, you know, having to cross this channel and land and just be almost vulnerable, you know, in this vulnerable position, landing on the beaches and so forth. So Tyre had this sort of natural protection, and it was, people thought no one would ever be able to defeat it. Tyre was a very important city. It was a commercial center and all that, and very strong fortified city. And no one thought it was possible to conquer it. And Alexander said, I can do that. But he didn't go the traditional route. He said, let me think. How do we get to them? And how do we get the troops to go there and not have the problems, the logistical problems of the water? And he said, let's just fill up the sea with dirt. I don't know what he used, but I don't know how he was able to do it, but I hope I'm not confusing this with another incident, but he literally built a bridge, a land bridge, from some point all the way to Tyre, so that his troops could walk on that and get to Tyre and attack it. So he overcame the water barrier problem by just going, thinking out of the box, and said, we can do this. We can fill up this water with dirt. And he literally built a dirt bridge into Tyre. Remarkable. And I think this is all related, because Tyre is like this liberal stronghold that has the stronghold in America. And if people said, were willing to listen to the truth and think out of the box and think of bold new ideas that defy traditional thinking, that are associated to the truth, the higher truth that conservatives keep rejecting. If we were willing to go up, surrender from 9 and go into 10, then these amazing ideas would come, and we'd be able to supernaturally overcome the city of Tyre. But no can do, you know. They don't want to do that, so it is what it is. So the thing is that Mussolini was born on the 29th of July, died on the 28th of April, 1945, kind of around the same time when Hitler supposedly died. And the thing is that he became the so-called prime minister on the 31st of October of 1922. And he stuck around until 1943. So he was the prime minister of Italy for 21 years. And the thing is, the thing that's very interesting about this is that I, up until a few hours ago, actually, I had thought all my life that Mussolini was this like a president dictator kind of person, that, you know, that he had just taken over the government and it was his, you know, to run at his will. And to a certain extent, it was. But turns out that Italy, I don't know if they still have a king. I think they might still have a king. I'm not sure. But at least at that time, they had a king. And it was like in the UK where, you know, you have a king. Well, you used to have a king or queen and a parliament. And the parliament, you know, is headed by a prime minister. But in Italy, so... Yeah, they had the same thing. They had a king, which I believe was Victor Emmanuel III or something like that. And he, but for some reason, he had a certain authority over who was prime minister. So even though Mussolini was practically running the country and doing all his stuff, there was still the king behind the scenes. As we explain here what happened to him, eventually you will see how the king eventually had a role to play in getting him out of there. So he was not this he didn't have, I don't know if that's the word, hegemony. He didn't have this just complete control over the country, you know, absolute control, the way, let's say, Hitler had over Germany. He was still under a king, supposedly, even though the king wasn't doing anything for a while. Eventually, that played a role in him being kicked out. And that's why Italy was always the soft underbelly that Churchill kept talking about, because it was not like invading Germany. And the thing is that Mussolini was, his father was a blacksmith. Interesting, that's the word that I was looking for a moment ago about this, someone forging a sword. You know, the conservatives are always, you know, praising the sword, and they never say anything bad about the sword, because they would be, it's like talking evil of the blacksmiths who built the sword. But the thing is that, his father, Alessandro Mussolini, was a blacksmith and a socialist. It says here, while his mother, Rosa Maltoni, that was her maiden name, was a devout Catholic school teacher. It says, given his father's political leanings, Mussolini was named Benito after liberal Mexican president Benito Juarez, while his middle names, Andrea and Amilcare, were for Italian socialists, Andrea Costa and Amilcare Cipriani. In return, the mother obtained that he be baptized at birth. Benito was the eldest of his parents, three children, his siblings, Arnaldo and Edvige, followed or whatever, Edvige or whatever. The thing is that it was like this compromise that the father was allowed to give him all these nasty names, and the mother said, okay, in return, let me baptize the kid. So they did the Catholic baptism thingy, and but Mussolini, and interestingly, in 1902, when he was around, what, like 19, Mussolini emigrated to Switzerland, partly to avoid compulsory military service. And that kind of draws my attention, because we were talking about Switzerland the other day with Tina Turner, that's where she died. And while he was there, he studied, you know, Nietzsche and other people. And he began to develop his philosophy. And he became active in the Italian socialist movement in Switzerland and things like that. So he became a socialist. And that's one thing, you know, when you think of fascism, you know, liberals always think, oh, Republicans, but, you know, they are the real fascists, the liberals. But that aside, historically, when you think of fascism, you think of Mussolini and you think of Hitler. And the liberals are always associating fascism with the right-wing extremism. But it's always the leftists, always the socialists, always the left-leaning people who go towards fascism. And it's because of that. And why? Because socialism requires a loyalty to the government. It's like saying you are going to commit, you're going to pledge loyalty, your soul is going to pledge loyalty to us, to the state. You are now a part of the collective. You don't have a value on your own. Your value comes from the collective. And we, the state, represent the collective. We are the representative entity on earth that symbolizes the collective you belong to. So you owe your loyalty to us. So it's like a selling of, you have to kind of bow and sell your soul and say, yes, I pledge my loyalty to the state. That's what socialism as it gets more intense, demands of you. And that's why, that's fascism. Dictatorship and fascism are different. And maybe we've said this before, and I apologize if we're repeating ourselves, but fascism is dictatorship plus a demand of surrender of yourself to the state, like a demand for loyalty. That's a dictatorship, for example. You can have a dictator who is running the country and everything, but he lets you live your life. You know, he gives you freedom to buy, sell, move around, do whatever you want. But his only condition is, you know, you don't mess with my power. Like you don't try to do a coup on me, because if you do, I'm gonna come and kill you. That's kind of what a dictator does, but he lets you live your life. He does not demand that you bow to him, that you have a picture of him, and you know, in your bedroom, like, and that you light a candle to his picture every night or something like that. He just wants to be in power, and then he just lets you be. Kind of like, for example, Pinochet in South America, evil man, but he allowed Chile to have this very free market economy. They prospered tremendously, economically at least, during his time in power. But if you said anything that was unpleasant to him, he was going to get you, and you would disappear and be gone for good. That's how he operated. But he didn't demand that you accept his ideology, that you accept that you know, drag queens can come and do shows in front of your children, and that you will accept it and like it. He didn't demand homosexual arrogance month, that you be proud of people sodomizing each other, and you're going to be proud of them whether you like it or not. You know, he just let Chileans be, you know, and doesn't justify, you know, his dictatorship. But we're trying to do the contrast of dictatorship versus fascism. Fascism demands you surrender and bow to the state, because the state is your raison d'être. It's what gives you your identity, your value, your sense of worth. And that's why in socialism is fascism, is conducive to fascism, because socialism demands surrender of the individual to the collective. And that's why socialism always degenerates in or produces fascism. And you may say, oh, Sweden is not fascist and they're socialists. No, they're not socialists. They are leading socialist. But basically what they do is they tax their people to death. But they have a very, very strong, or used to have before the immigration crisis, they used to have a very sound moral culture, where ethical, where, you know, you are putting out a lot of money into the public pot but no one is going to abuse that pot, and you know, people are going to receive benefits from that public pot, but no one's going to abuse the system, and everybody's going to be doing their part, working hard, and putting a whole bunch of money into this public pot and then distribute it. But it's a very, very stifling lifestyle. That's why, even though they are wealthy and all that, they are, you know, culturally stagnant, in the sense of having no creativity, no life. You don't hear of Danish rock bands topping the charts all over the world, or you know, they don't have that sort of level of achievement because there's something stifling about living under this tax oppression. But that's all it is. It's a capitalist society that just has a lot of taxes and kind of forces people to give away a lot of money and then gives it back in the forms of a lot of free services. But the people respect there's an element of moral integrity in the culture that prevents that system collapsing because it's not abused by the people there. It's not, people don't take advantage of the freebies, and play the system, or game the system, if you catch what I'm trying to say. So socialism always leads to fascism. This guy Mussolini was socialist, but yes, you know, it is true that later on in his life, he decided that socialism was. So he officially stopped being a socialist, but so he started kind of leaning towards nationalism instead of socialism, and he began to kind of think of socialism as. As having faltered, and he believed that that it was kind of like a f that it had been tried and it wasn't working, so he kind of gave up on socialism, at least in theory. But his heart was still towards that belief in the state, the state. But then what happened afterwards showed that he eventually. Because he was part of the Italian Socialist Party, he was eventually expelled from the party, and he went on his own, you could say. But he eventually went back to socialism, as we will hopefully get to at some point. The thing is that he was the quote prime minister of Italy during World War II, and we had this. But he was overthrown through the efforts, you know, when the Allies finally attacked Italy, and they did it from Africa, you could say. And to do that, so let's go back to the African campaign. There was this operation called Operation Torch that happened from the 8th of November 1942 through the 16th of November of 42. So it was like an 8-day campaign. It was an Allied invasion of French North Africa during the Second World War, and it says here Torch was a compromise operation. I'm reading from the Wikipedia article that met the British objective of securing victory in North Africa while allowing American armed forces the opportunity to engage in the fight against Nazi Germany on a limited scale. It was the first massive involvement of U.S. troops in the European North African theater and saw the first major airborne assault carried out by the United States. So basically, Operation Torch was the inauguration of American involvement on the European, quote, European slash African front. That's basically Operation Torch. That's when it started. 8th of November, 1942. Remember the Day of Infamy, quote unquote, 7th of December, 1941. It's almost 1 year. To the date, actually 11 months plus a day. That's how long it took for America to finally start fighting Hitler. Think about that. And who, thanks to whom? Son of a bitch, polio boy. And that's where the infamy comes in a sense. So the thing is that they were able to come in, and we won't go into the details. They had a lot of conflicts. Because they didn't, that part, you know, they invaded Casablanca and all that, if I'm not mistaken. Yes,
that was controlled by the French, but the French they were French who were loyal to the French Vichy, I think they were called, who were loyal to the Germans. So they were kind of traitors, and so there was ambiguity on whether the French would fight the Allies or how much they would fight, and they did fight, but kind of gave up very quickly. You know, they were French, so they quit. Very quickly, and they started doing a deal, like a peace deal with the Allies. So that's why the operation only took 8 days, and that got Hitler really angry, and because he had kind of left the south of France to be run by the Vichy French fellows, and but kind of let almost like a dictatorship kind of situation. The thing we were saying a moment ago. That, okay, we're not going to be fascistic on you. Just do your thing as long as you don't turn on us. And when he saw the betrayal, you can call it the betrayal of the betrayers, because they were, you know, people who had betrayed France, so they ended up betraying Hitler. So it's betrayers, betrayers betraying those they were betraying with, if that makes any sense. The thing is that... when Hitler saw that, he said, okay, I'm really angry. So he went and sent troops into the south of France and kind of eventually took over. So it's like, oh, no longer autonomy and independence. I can't trust in you. So he basically took full control of all of France because of that. But we had a foothold in Africa. And then the fighting continued. And eventually, we got to the point where we were able to do the Allied to the invasion of Sicily, but it took a while. The invasion of Sicily happened in July of 1943, so the thing is that. We invaded Italy in July of 1943, and the campaign was from the 9th of July to the 17th of August of 43. So it lasted, 5 weeks more or less, and the Allies won, and we took over Sicily, and that became, you know, the point from which we were able to then, and that led. Conquest of Italy led to the fall of Mussolini, the conquest of Sicily, I mean, what is interesting, because Mussolini did not have this tight grip on Italy the way Hitler did on Germany, and when Sicily was lost, it kind of made Mussolini very unpopular, and that eventually led to him being put out of commission, shall we say. What happened was he became very unpopular, and that's when internally in Italy they decided to get rid of him, and they got Victor Emmanuel get rid of him, and so Victor Emmanuel eventually dismissed him, and he was taken out of power, so let me read the article here on that. It says, by 1943, Italy's military position had become untenable. Axis forces in North Africa were finally defeated in the Tunisia campaign in early 43. Italy suffered major setbacks on the Eastern Front as well. The Allied invasion of Sicily brought the war to the nation's very doorstep. The Italian home front was also in bad shape, as the Allied bombings were taking their toll. Factories all over Italy were brought to a virtual standstill because raw materials such as coal and oil were lacking. But there was also chronic food shortage. He lost control of the people. The people just didn't like him anymore. So then there were labor strikes and things like that. So eventually, there was some sort of legal procedure, which there were legal proceedings in place to kind of get rid of him. And they started going through the legal process. And Mussolini thought, legal schmiegel. So he just showed up for work the next day as usual. It says here, he allegedly viewed the Grand Council as merely an advisory board, did not think the vote would have any substantive effect. But that afternoon at 1700 hours, he was summoned to the royal palace by Victor Emmanuel, the king. By then, Victor Emmanuel had already decided to sack him. The king had arranged an escort for Mussolini and had the government building surrounded by 200 carabinieri, the police people there. Mussolini was unaware of these moves by the king and tried to tell him about the Grand Council meeting. Victor Emmanuel cut him off and formally dismissed him from office, although guaranteeing his immunity. After Mussolini left the palace, he was arrested by the carabinieri on the king's orders. The police took Mussolini in a Red Cross ambulance without specifying his destination, assuring him that they were doing it for his own safety. By this time, discontent with Mussolini was so intense that when the news of his downfall was announced on the radio, there was no resistance of any sort. People rejoiced because they believed that the end of Mussolini also meant the end of the war. The king appointed another guy, Pietro Badoglio, as the new prime minister. So eventually, Mussolini was able to escape. And he got help from the Germans, and they set up this puppet. Hitler helped to set up this puppet government that was called the Italian Social Republic. That was also known as the Salò Republic because of the city where it was based from, I think. It was this city country in the upper half of Italy, of the Italian boot, peninsula. And it was controlled by the Germans, and Mussolini was the kind of like the puppet, figurehead. There, he didn't really have much power, but he was there as a figurehead, and he was, quote, relatively safe there. And he stayed there in this Italian social republic until the end of the war. And at the end of the war, when the Allies were finally taking over everything, then the communists and some other people, Italians, were so angry at him that they decided to hang him and a whole bunch of other people. And he ended up dying by hanging the hands of the Italians. But at the end of, he was in that place, in that position of power, he began to kind of go back to his socialism roots. Let me just quickly go to that. Just to emphasize that some people might say he was really not a socialist because he was kicked out of the Socialist Party and everything, but he really, went back to those roots when he was in control of that territory. Let me just read here. It says, during the existence of the Italian Social Republic, I'm reading from the Italian Social Republic article on Wikipedia, Mussolini, whose former government had banned trade unions and strikes, began to make increasingly populist appeals to the working class. He claimed to regret many of the decisions made earlier in supporting the interests of big business and promised a new beginning if the Italian people would be willing to grant him a second chance. Mussolini claimed that he had never totally abandoned his left-wing influences, insisting he had attempted to nationalize property in 39 through 40, but had been forced to delay such action for tactical reasons related to the war with the removal of the monarchy. Mussolini claimed the full ideology of fascism could be pursued. Interesting. So to pursue the full ideology of fascism, people say, oh, there's no king anymore because, we're here in this territory that I'm not under any king, accountable to any king. I can now do fascism. And fascism means doing socialism. Remember the word Nazi is short for National Socialists. So the Nazis were socialists. They were left-wing radicals. They always are thought of as right-wing extremists. And when you think of right-wing extremists, you think of Nazis and stuff. No, Nazis are left-wingers. The nut jobs, the fascists, are always left-wingers. And so it says, Mussolini claimed the full ideology of fascism could be pursued. And to gain popular support, he reversed over 20 years the fascist policy of backing private property and relative economic independence by ordering the nationalization of all companies with over 100 employees. But this is, they're phrasing it as if to say that that he was turning on his fascism, and that's not the case. He was living out the fascism. Mussolini even reached out to ex-communist Nicola Bombacci to help him in spreading the image that fascism was a progressive movement. The economic policy of the RSI, Republic, Italian Socialist Republic, or Repubblica something, Socialist of Italy, was given the name socialization, and Mussolini had even considered the idea of calling his new republic Italian Socialist Republic. In practice, little resulted from the declared socialization of the economy, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is that he was always a socialist at heart. I think that he had a bit of a pragmatic thing. And the fact that he was not a full socialist, that's part of the reason why he was so easily put out of power, if you see what I'm saying. If he had been a full socialist fascist the way Hitler was, he would have never been able to, no one would have been able to kind of take him out so easily. And I keep thinking, if the king could have sacked him so easily, why did it take him so long to sack him? So you start wondering, what was Victor Emmanuel thinking, you know? The point is that fascism is always strongly connected to socialism. It may differ a little bit from communism in the sense that or it may seem to differ because communism is more open and demanding certain things. Fascism, you can be, when you're a communist, you're a fascist. See, it's like fascism is like a, communism is a subset of fascism. Let's put it that way. So you can be a fascist without being a communist, where you give a certain level of freedom, but you still demand the complete loyalty. You know, Hitler kept demanding that people do the Sieg Heil thingy, and that they would, you know, revere the swastika flag and the symbol, and that they have Hitler's mustache picture on their kitchen walls. And so he demanded that loyalty, you know. The Nazi youth and all that, you know, from early age, you know, the state controls your life. The children are not yours. They're the state's. We decide if we want to, you know, control their sexual orientation. You have no control. We decide, you know, that sort of attitude of surrender, of loyalty. And he didn't have that full, he was not fully fascist. And even though the word fascist has an Italian origin, it's ironic that he was not as fascist as Hitler. And that's why, not as fascist, not as socialist as Hitler. And hence, that's why he was weaker in that sense and didn't hold on to power. And he was then eventually hanged by his own people. So now the thing is, we wanted to get to go through all this to point out that America got involved until Operation Torch, which happened 11 months after Pearl Harbor. And then it took us from the 8th of November of 42 to the invasion of Sicily, which was in July of 43. That is 8 months. It took us 8 months to do that. It's easy for me to say because I wasn't there, but I would dare say that if we had made a full commitment to really attack Germany and we could have not only started Operation Torch much earlier, but we would have been able to probably do the invasion of Sicily in much less time because We took over, that Casablanca area in Operation Torch. We had a foothold, a very strong foothold, and it would have been if we had been committed to it, we could have jumped from there and maybe taken over some other launching place in Africa, in North Africa, and then just go ahead and go and attack Italy. Stop wasting time in Africa. There was a lot of fighting going on there, and what for? Is North Africa was nothing more than a launching pad. That's all it was. But we spent too much time preparing the launching pad and decorating it and putting all these little things, ribbons and all these and decorations and extra paintings and stuff on it, when it's just a launching pad. Just get a foothold and boom, just go and attack what you really are after. And we could have invaded Sicily long before that, in July 43. And then when Sicily was invaded, then we went through Italy pretty quickly. Mussolini got kicked out of power. I mean, we didn't have to do a single thing. The Italians did it for us. And then he went and set up, this little weak kingdom in the north of Italy, this Italian Socialist Republic, and we took over Italy, or Italy became an ally, and we didn't do a damn thing with that. So we sat on that. So from July 43, when Mussolini was taken out of power, we basically had Italy. And yes, he kept the northern third, you could say, of Italy, with the help of the Germans who came to help him and set up this puppet regime there. But now we were in the continent. We had the foothold. We were literally in the boot of the continent. We were in the boot of the continent. We just had to just storm up and attack. But Polio Boy kept saying no, 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 no. And he kept waiting. And from July 43 to June 44, that's 11 more months of useless waiting. What the hell were we waiting for? What the hell were we waiting for? And you know what we were waiting for? Well, not we, but Polio Boy was waiting for the Russians to start kicking butt on their front. And that's what he wanted to do. He wanted, because FDR was a communist at heart. He was a communist. And if you don't believe it, just go look up his last State of the Union speech, one of his last ones, or maybe the last one, where he starts talking about the need to add human rights. We've talked about this before, to the Constitution, that should be there and are not there. And you go, oh, so he was thinking about the things we're talking about in these audio snippets. No, he was thinking about some other human rights, like the right to have a house, the right to be to have a job, the right to food. Those are not rights. That's socialist communist thinking. When you say, oh, the people have a right to a house, then if you don't have a house, then obviously then that's implying then the government has to provide one for you. So for the government to provide one for you, the government has to own the house to give it to you. So then the government starts taking over, and the government needs money from other people to pay for the house that you have a right to by some magic divine decree or demonic decree. So he was a communist. Only a communist talks like that. And for him to be saying these things, because he had always wanted to say these things, but he knew he couldn't because he was in America. But he was a communist at heart. And as his time in power continued, he became, and as the war was raging and our hearts were somewhere else, he began to say, okay, now I want to let the cat out of the bag. And he started saying all these things. He's the one who put us into this economic disaster path with Social Security and all these communist or socialist concepts that have us with a debt of, what, $30, $35 trillion, unsustainable, unfunded liabilities and all this. It was all started by this communist son of a bitch. he wanted the Russians, the Soviets, to win. So he was giving them time to expand and conquer Eastern Europe. And that's why when he finally committed to an invasion, he wanted to do it from the other side. He didn't want to do it from Italy, because that would have been nice. Italy is right next door to Germany. It's like right there. It's like, boom, just go in. Boom, boom, boom. You're done. It's over. But no, that would have been too fast, and it would not have given the Russians enough time to advance on the Eastern Front. So he said, oh, let's do it from Normandy. So he waited and waited and waited and waited and waited. So he finally, committed to the invasion from Normandy. And that's when, the Americans just began to, Americans and the rest of the Allies, there were Canadians and other people. So it was not just the Americans, obviously, the British. But it was mostly Americans and British just began to, boom, just barrel on through. And like knife through butter, supernaturally cutting through. But as they were doing that, then the Russians began advance very quickly on the Eastern Front, and we had no way of stopping. We couldn't get to, when we finally got to Germany, the Russians got there first, and that's why Germany got split into Eastern and Western Germany for 40 plus years, and we had the Berlin division, and eventually the Berlin Wall, and we all know the story, because we gave them time to advance. Polio boy gave them time to advance. So in a sense, D-Day is a day that will live in infamy, because it is not because of the braveness of the people who carried out something we had to do all this time, but had not done, but because of how long it took to get there. And this is symbolic of everything that's going on right now. America has been delaying, and to the point that now the delay has gotten so profound that there is no turning back now, and there will be no rescuing rescuing America from Hitler. Figuratively speaking, thinking of continental Europe as America, it's gone. It will never be recovered. And I think that's what this D-Day represented. So now let me go very quickly to the other things I wanted to mention. On the 7th of June, and the next day, it was a day here in the New York area where it was filled with, and I'm sure you read this in the news, this apocalyptic haze that people were calling it, of smoke, and the air quality was very bad and all that. And to me, this was symbolic of the decay of the country, the decay of the city. And in a very specific way, it was like a fitting figure of what I've been complaining about in a very literal way about the cannabis smell. All these people releasing all this cannabis into the air and forcing everybody else to breathe it against their will, the atmosphere of death that fills the city because of that cannabis, and how New Yorkers have, and the liberals and the Democrats are also happy with that, and don't give a damn about anybody else. I felt such a joy to have all this air that these people were all so scared about. And now they're worried about how unhealthy the air is, and they had no way of escaping it. And it's like, when you're out in the park and the cannabis smell just hits you, it's like you have nowhere to run because the smell is just fills the whole place. So it's like giving New Yorkers a taste of what they've been trying to give me. And I said, oh, it's fitting. And I had the window open all day. To me, it was not a problem. For some reason, it didn't really affect me. But everybody was wearing masks. And I remember going to buy donuts during my lunch break, and they had the radio on. And the guy was saying, this is the most toxic the air has been in New York since 1964. And that's fitting because 1964 was the year of the Civil Rights Act, when finally, black people began to have the freedom that we didn't give, that America didn't give them a long time ago. Even after the end of the Civil War, you know, which ended in 1865, 99 years later, and they were still enslaved in a figurative way. And so it's interesting, 1964 was the year of the liberation of black people, the true beginning of the liberation of black people. And ironically, it's the black people who do the cannabis contamination the most. It's as if to say, what have you done with the freedom that's been given to you? Since 1964, black culture has just degraded and degraded and degraded. And now they, you know, it's always black people smoking cannabis. Like when I feel the smell, I look around, it's almost always a black man or a black woman just smoking it up, a group of black people. When I go to New York and I see people on the street, black people standing on the street, like, oh my goodness, it's gonna be, just gonna smell cannabis. And most of the time, I that's what exactly what I smell is. And yes, I've seen Hispanics do that a lot too. And sometimes one white guy here or there, but it's almost always black people. So it's fitting that it has. This was the most toxic the air was supposedly since 1964. It's kind of like a way of saying, yeah, you were given freedom in 64 and look what you're doing now. You're filling the air with cannabis, figuratively and literally. Your culture is stinks to high heaven, and you don't want to change, and you're contaminating the country with the stink of your culture, and the value system that you uphold and that you're that you defend and that you defend with the racism card constantly. So it was fitting. I'm just going to mention this very quickly. There was this article on the Independent, I think it's from the UK. It's posted on Yahoo News, but I think it's from the Independent in the UK. And it says, welcome to the apocalyptic case of the new abnormal. There's nowhere left to hide. And I said, wow, interesting. That's exactly how I feel when the cannabis smoke starts coming. And then they start blaming global warming. And then they start saying, oh, yeah, the hot climate is more conducive to all these wildfires. And I go, you stupid. And the name of the authors are Susan Hassel and Michael Mann. Stupid bitch and bastard. These two idiots, ignorant idiots, don't know that this summer or this spring in New York has been unusually cold. I mean, I was amazed on June 8th when I was outside. It was at night, June 8th. I remember when I was a kid, when June came along, it's all of the hot days of summer. It was like unbearable heat and humidity and all that stuff. I remember when I was a kid. And June 8th, it was chilly outside at night. It was like, and there have been days that I've been outside in recent days and it's chilly. It's you can't just wear normal summer clothing without, you know, feeling the cold. Last Sunday, I was sitting on a park bench and the wind was blowing. It was like cold. And I said, my goodness, this is end of May, early June. What is going on? So these guys are attributing it to the weather. There's nothing to do with the weather. Nothing. It's unusually cold. Not cold like, you know, like a wintry cold. Don't get me wrong, but relatively speaking, there are days that you go outside and it's 60 some degrees in Fahrenheit, and it's chilly, and especially with the wind blowing, because for some reason the wind has been blowing very nastily, and you start shivering a bit. So this has nothing to do with quote global warming, especially here. So see how they do these connections that have nothing to do with reality. But there is a reality in what they were saying. Welcome to the apocalyptic case of the new abnormal. There's nowhere to left to hide. Yeah, this environment where everybody's smoking cannabis and all that, it's like, this is abnormal. Welcome to the new abnormal. So this is the state, that day was a day to reflect the state of New York and the state of the country. So that was June the 7th. And now let me get to June the 8th. I'm way out of time. I'm not sure if I'll be able to say all that I needed to say. But on June the 8th, that was a very significant day. Interestingly, just like I had shared before, something that I had never expected to happen on May 24th, the day that Tina Turner died. I had a very similar thing happen again on June 8th. And I knew that it would happen on that day. It was like, I knew with anticipation that it would happen on June 8th, almost the same kind of thing, you could say. And I had never, if you had asked me back in April, if I would have ever had that happen in one time, I would have said no way. And it ended up happening twice within a span of 15 days. So it is very peculiar. And then on June 8th, just like on May 24th, two very important things happened. Someone died, and there was something very important related to the, quote, presidential campaigns. On June 8th, same thing. Someone very relevant died on June 8th, and then there was something very relevant related to presidential campaigns. Let me get that to that very, very quickly. I'm way out of time. But on June 8th, I found out about this in the early morning hours of June 8th, and I found out by accident. I was going to this one of the three conservative sites I go to. I forget which one. I clicked on a link about a story. I don't remember what the story was right now, but it took me to the website TMZ or TMZ. It's a very popular website in America. It's about, you know, Hollywood gossip stories and stuff like that. They even have a TV show called TMZ or TMZ. And I used to kind of watch it a little bit when that's a long time ago, to my shame. But the thing is that they had this story about something, I forget what it was. And after reading through it, I started scrolling down, and I saw, for some reason, I felt the need to scroll down. And they had stories about a rapper, blah blah blah, and couldn't care less. And I kept going, and then I saw this headline, and it said, Pat Robertson has died at age, I think, 83 or something, I forget the age, but it was, and I said, say what? And I clicked on it, and TMZ or TMZ had this story on the death of Pat Robertson, and it said, Pat Robertson died in the early morning, Thursday, and June the 8th was a Thursday, and I was reading this in the early hours of the morning. And I was expecting a hit piece, you know, because, you know, TMZ is, you know, it's Hollywood-ish, so you would expect the writers all to be, you know, nut job liberals, and a lot of them are, I think. But the one who runs the website or that whole thing, who used to host the TV show, he's a kind of a down-to-earth fellow. And in fact, I think he actually was a Trump supporter for a while. The thing, and I forget his name, he's a Jewish fellow. That's all I remember. I see his face in my head, but I don't remember his name. But he seems very down to earth. But he doesn't write every article. And I know that there are a lot of nut job liberals who work around him. So I thought it was going to be a hit piece against Pat Robertson. And because Pat Robertson, if you don't know, was a conservative Christian. He was the person who started the 700 Club and all that stuff. So I was and very conservative and criticizing homosexuality and all that stuff. So I thought he was gonna be attacked like, oh, the far right, low conservative extremist, Pat Robertson has died. I was expecting, you know, smear after smear. And I was expecting the word controversial because it's always interesting to me when liberals write about people who are not liberal. It's always the controversial person so-and-so. But when they're writing about someone that they like, even if they're controversial to the to other people, they never use the word controversial, which is controversial in and of itself. But the thing is that the word controversial was not even used. And the person who wrote this story wrote the most wonderful story. It wasn't like praising him or anything. He's just stating the facts. He started like this and this and this, and he didn't have any money at the beginning, and he started he felt led but to buy a TV station or do something, and he gave away all his money, and then he blah blah blah. And this story about what he did, he ran for president in 88. I remember that when he ran for president in 88. And then the story ended, and not a single pot shot. And I said, oh, wow. And then I thought that, and then, because it was in the early hours of the morning, so I wasn't, you know, like, wasn't processing too well. So, okay, Pat Robertson has died, but I wasn't sure. Because maybe this is an old link. I wasn't quite sure what had happened. So I let it go and then went about my day. And then I went to the, you know, websites, the conservative websites, to read the headlines. And I wasn't seeing anything about Pat Robertson. So I kind of, to a certain extent, kind of forgot about it. And then late at night, on that 8th of June, I said, no, did he really die? Today, so I did a search again, and yes, lo and behold, yeah, he had died. And there were other headlines in some other, you know, liberal websites, talking about him having passed away. And then I kept going to the conservative sites that I go to, and not a single one mentioned anything. And even on the 9th of June, the next day, nothing, not a single mention of his death. And I think even now, if I went right now to those three sites, I think they would still not have any link on that. And I go, what? And that, to me, was very significant because it kind of pointed to the thing we were sharing about how on May 24th, all the conservatives turned their backs to those who searched for the truth. They said, we're not just going to pretend you're not there. We're going to turn our back on you and oppose you and show you how much we disdain you, and we're going to build a dam with our backs to prevent any river of your truth to come into America. And it's as if they all kind of boycotted, decided to say, we're not going to talk about him dying. And I go, why? And then I began to kind of think about him a little bit, and I realized it makes sense. Even though I don't agree with him in many things, But let me just say this very quickly, and I don't know if I'll have time, but Pat Robertson, he was born into a Southern Baptist family. And so Southern Baptists don't believe in Pentecostal stuff and the things of the Spirit. Every time I would kind of flip through the channels and go through and maybe see the 700 Club, and I just stay there just to listen. And I find it interesting that he would start talking about, oh, I see this person that this has this disease or something, and I'm praying for him or her, whatever. And so that said to me, oh, it's interesting, because I could feel that he was the sort of person who's willing to go outside the box every now and then. He's not just stuck in what he's been told and just using the sword that is given to him, that was forged and given to him, and just using it and hacking everything with that same sword. It's like the sort of person who I think one of his favorite passages was some passage of Proverbs, in the book of Proverbs, I think, that says something about lean not on your own understanding, but trust the Lord in all your ways, and he will direct your path, or something like that. I'm not very good at quoting biblical passages, but that's kind of what it says, and he tried to live his life by that. And when a person tries to think like that, is lean not to your own understanding means you know, don't just rely on the things that you already know and think you know, and you think you have it all complete and you're all, to, you know, you're, that you got it all. So he was willing to not just lean on his own understanding, but to constantly seek. So he, every now and then, deviated from the conservative propaganda or the conservative, you know, train of thought. And I don't agree with many of the things he said. And I don't think, I can't come up with too many things in my head to begin with, but I have a basic disagreement with certain little things. So he was by no means someone who was expounding truth and all that. But let me tell you what I felt in my heart. It's as if when he died, and, you know, and it's as if he was, I could see him being told everything that he didn't understand. And I know this is going to sound weird, but I don't know if it was like that, but it's as if he was being told the things that are said in these audio snippets and audio clips, you know, not necessarily that saying, so-and-so had this audio recorded, but, you know, the basic ideas that are in the audio snippet, at least. And he was being told all these things that he missed, and I could see him sobbing unconsolably. As to say, Lord, I wish I'd known these things. I wish I'd known these things. I knew there was something extra, but I didn't know where to look, how to look. I am so sorry I missed it. And I see sorrow, and I see him crying very deeply as he's standing there listening to the things he missed. And I see sincere sorrow. So the man, even though he didn't find the truth, the way he needed to, I think he had a heart that was kind of inclining towards that. He just didn't get there. But now that you could say, it's as if he now knows all that he missed, and he grieves in his heart that he didn't know it when he was alive. And I think that core attitude in him is what has shunned him, in the hearts of all these conservatives who have not a single conservative website has made a mention of him having died. And he was and even the liberals were saying he is the one who put evangelical Christians in politics. He's the one who brought in the conservative Christian, you know, coalition, who made Christians relevant inside the Republican Party. And that was, he built on top of what Ronald Reagan had done, you could say, but he is the one who kind of made it relevant for Christians to participate and have a voice in the Republican Party. And so he's a very transformational figure in that sense, you know, whether for good or not good, that's up to you to decide, but at least you could say that he is the one who basically said, Christians, you can do something about changing the world, and here's an avenue. And when he didn't win in 88, he didn't obsess with it. He just said, okay, that's it. I gave it my best shot. It's not meant to be, and I'll move on. So he was not obsessed about doing things, you know, from a political perspective, like legislating morality and doing that. But he knew that there was a role to play for all these Christians to change the country and change the world. And so he was very, very relevant. And he was one of the more relevant Americans, I would say, in the 20th century. I don't know in what position I'd put him, but he was very relevant. And the fact that he passed away, not a single conservative decided to put even a link to his passing on their websites. That is shocking to me, and that is a confirmation of that. And then at the same time, the other thing that happened on June the 8th was that Trump was indicted for these possession of documents and whatever. And I was reading this article in the Daily Mail, Alan Dershowitz being interviewed about it. And apparently, Dershowitz is kind of a supporter of Trump in the sense of supporting him when he's being attacked unfairly. But this time he says, This I'm reading from the Daily Mail. It says, "This indictment is stronger than I anticipated in one respect and in one respect only. It has the text of a conversation between Trump and a writer in which Trump says, 'Look, I know these documents that I have in my hand are secret. I could have declassified them. I didn't. Here, I'm going to show them to you to prove my point.' That does seem to be evidence that at least there was some documents that President Trump knew were not unclassified and classified. He had them in his possession. Whether his documents were actually given to an unauthorized person to read or just flashed before his eyes or as part of typical Trump bravado, the government's going to have to prove." And then he says, "Somebody I know once gave him a gift of a fish that had been caught and stuffed and put on a plaque. And the plaque said, 'If I had only kept my mouth shut, I'd still be swimming.' President Trump is going to have to look in the mirror and say, 'Why did I allow myself to be taped in a conversation with a writer when I knew I was being taped?' Trump has obviously a history and a reputation of speaking too much and getting himself into trouble. This may be the worst sentence he ever uttered in terms of his own protection from criminal prosecution. It's the only page in the indictment which I think stands up to scrutiny." So everything is just a hogwash, he's saying, but that one thing. And I don't know if the recording is real, but what I'm trying to get at is he, as we said before, the protection on him is gone. He was protected to do something. He failed to do it. And now the protection from his own stupidity and his own childishness sometimes is gone. So now he's on his own. And he thinks he still has the protection. He still has the same bravado and says whatever comes to his mind. But now the things that are coming to his mind are not filtered by that protection, that layer of protection. So he's going to be saying some stupid things. And we said this before in previous audio recordings. And if this is true, what is being said about this recording is true, then that's an example of that. And a whole bunch of ex-presidents, he was not a president, as we've said before, but you know, using the tech filter. A lot of ex-presidents have kept classified documents. You know, Bite Me had classified documents in the garage, just stashed away, and there are pictures of them. No one's doing a damn thing. And the thing is, this happened because on that same day, Bite Me, there was a document that the FBI finally surrendered that to the House, to the Republicans in the House, showing that he was participating in a scheme of getting money from the Ukrainians to stop an investigation of Burisma, whatever, in the Ukraine. So they did this indictment on that same day to kind of like cover up that other story that came out. So they had been planning this all along. Like they were waiting. If we're going to do this indictment on a day when we want to kind of hide something else. So in order to take attention away from that other document that proved that's evidence that the FBI finally surrendered, they did this on the 8th of June. So it's a very relevant day. There was something that happened from the 6th to the 7th to the 8th of June. The 6th of June, the day signifying what America failed to do. We tried to go from 7 to 9 without the regeneration of 8, without regenerating our system. And we never went into the transition into 10 and surrendering the sword that we've been using to enter into a new dimension. Then the 7th is, you know, Black America contaminating the atmosphere with cannabis instead of being on the watchtower to talk about warn us about the end of times. And then the 8th of June, the day that a man that should have been honored in some way by the conservatives who owe so much to him, they turned their back on him and showed him, we don't care about you. And then at the same time, Trump had this indictment. Just like on the 24th of May, Tina Turner died and DeSantis announced his candidacy. On the 8th of June, Pat Robertson died and Trump was indicted. And this is probably the most serious indictment, even though it's all political persecution, but it all happened on the 8th of June. And that's what we wanted to say about those 3 days. I thought it was going to be much faster than this, but that's what we had to say about those 3 days. And I hope it make some sense in your heart and mind. Thank you very much for listening.